The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from the Week magazine dated January 20th, 2012. And our first article from the week this week from the main story section is entitled, Romney's Rivals Intensify Their Attacks. What happened? Mitt Romney took a major step towards securing the Republican Party's nomination for president this past week as he overcame increasingly hostile attacks by his rival candidates to win the New Hampshire primary. With his 16-point victory over second-place finisher Ron Paul, Romney became the first non-incumbent Republican candidate to win both the Iowa and the New Hampshire contests. His victory sets up the South Carolina primary, which is coming up on January 21st, as a pivotal contest. Another Romney win would effectively end the race, while rivals Rick Santorum and Rick Perry and Newt Gingrich all hope to give new life to their campaigns in a state more friendly to Southerners and Christian conservatives. Super PACs supporting Gingrich and Perry plan to spend about $5 million on ads attacking Romney as an unprincipled moderate and corporate raider whose greed costs thousands of middle-class people their jobs. This will be the last stand for some candidates, said Republican strategist Adam Temple, and they will go down fighting. The focus of the rivals' attacks is on Romney's business career at Bain Capital, the private equity firm he co-founded and ran for 14 years. Gingrich characterized Romney's work at Bain as buying and looting struggling companies, while Perry branded him a vulture. Romney accused desperate Republicans of undermining the party's support for free enterprise and playing into President Obama's hands. This is such a mistake for our party and for the nation, he said. The country already has a leader who divides us with the bitter politics of envy. Now here's what the editorials had to say. It will be hard for conservatives to stop Romney now, said the Wall Street Journal. Despite his inability to excite the GOP's conservative base, his electability and leadership have won over a plurality of primary voters, while his opponents have diluted the non-Romney vote. Santorum may have the best remaining chance to build on his social conservative base, while Gingrich and Perry have only weakened themselves with crude and damaging attacks on capitalism worthy of Michael Moore. But Romney hasn't been honest about his role at Bain, said the New York Times. He claims he produced a net gain of 100,000 jobs and that his business experience qualifies him to be president. But his campaign can't back up those job creation numbers. What we do know is that a fifth of the companies Bain took over while he was in charge later went bankrupt with thousands of workers sent packing. It's this kind of leveraged capitalism that has cost so many Americans their jobs, while enriching executives and investors, producing the vast inequality we have today. And now here's what the columnist said. Romney has only himself to blame for the harsh scrutiny of Bain, said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post. He falsely portrayed Bain's goal as job creation when it was actually wealth creation for a small group of super-rich investors. In both the primaries and the general election, Romney will be haunted by heart-rending stories of people fired from factories and offices while he was in charge, now part of a 28-minute film created by Gingrich supporters. This should be a concern for Republicans, said Michael Walsh in the New York Post. Romney is now the presumptive nominee, and Democrats will already be measuring him up for the Occupy Wall Street 1%er Memorial bad guy suit. That's one reason the not-mid-mood in conservative circles is intensifying, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. Conservatives also find him uninspiring and relentlessly inauthentic. He keeps insisting he spent his life as a businessman, for example, when everyone knows he's been running for office since the 1990s. Many conservatives are holding out hope that Romney's rivals now win a few primaries to the GOP, or so the GOP can find a better candidate at a brokered convention. Romney will have to withstand 10 days of hell in South Carolina, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. He'll be hoping his record of success will quell conservative calls for a nominee they can believe in. But the Republican base may not be ready to settle yet. The Palmetto State will either be the last stand of the anti-Romney forces or the place where they turn the tide. And the next item from the main story section in the week this week is rising tensions in Iran. The U.S. and Iran moved closer to confrontation this week after an Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated in Tehran and the Islamic Republic threatened to attack American ships entering the Strait of Hormuz. Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, a director of the Natanz Uranium Enrichment Facility, where Western leaders suspect Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, died after a motorcyclist attached a magnetic explosive device to his car. Iranian officials blame the terrorist action on America and Israel. The assassination came just days after the regime sentenced Amir Mizari Hekmata, a U.S. citizen of Iranian descent, to death for spying for the CIA. Washington denied that the former Marine was a spy and said it had played no role in Roshan's assassination. The war with Iran already has begun, said Con Coughlin in the London Telegraph. Western intelligence services have now assassinated four nuclear scientists in 2 years, blown up the country's leading missile expert, and disabled Iran's nuclear computer system with the Stuxnet computer virus. Long may this covert campaign continue. Far better to destroy the threat posed by Iran's nuclear program by stealth than to waste the lives of young American and British soldiers in another fight that nobody wants. But such a campaign is not without huge risks, said Julian Borger in the London Guardian. So far, the Iranian regime has avoided overt reprisals, but elements of the establishment are starting to lash out in frustration, as shown by last October's thwarted bomb plot against the Saudi ambassador to Washington, apparently the work of the Revolutionary Guard. If the West continues its covert operations, this increasingly autonomous force could attack U.S. vessels in the Strait of Hormuz, triggering a devastating conflict in shipping lanes through which a fifth of the world's oil exports pass. These furtive killings could also cause Iran to speed up its nuclear program, said Jeffrey Goldberg in the Atlantic.com. If I were a member of the Iranian regime, I'd take this assassination program to mean that the West is entirely uninterested in any form of negotiation. I'd ramp up uranium refinement and attempt to join the nuclear weapons club as fast as possible. Once I do that, I'm North Korea or Pakistan, an untouchable country. The next item from the main story section of the week, a brightening jobs picture. In a sign that the economic recovery may be gaining momentum, the U.S. added 200,000 jobs in December, pushing the unemployment rate down to 8.5%, its lowest level since February 2009. It was the sixth month in a row that the Labor Department reported the creation of at least 100,000 jobs, and the gains spanned such sectors as transportation, manufacturing, and even construction. But economists warn that the U.S. still faces tough economic headwinds. President Obama, who hopes a reinvigorated economy will improve his reelection chances, expressed cautious optimism. The economy is moving in the right direction, he said, but there are a lot of people that are still hurting out there. File this report under Unmitigated Good News, said Felix Salmon in Reuters.com. There's much to cheer. Average wages increased, public sector layoffs slowed, and the broadest measure of unemployment, which includes people who aren't currently looking for work, fell to a 3-year low. Even though the stubborn problem of long-term joblessness remains, I'm not worried about an economy falling below stall speed anymore. But can it last? Asked Bloomberg.com in an editorial. We've had a run of good economic news. Manufacturing is expanding. Auto sales and consumer confidence are up. But any sense of security is misbegotten. The U.S. economy still isn't growing fast enough to weather fallout from Europe's festering debt crisis or a hard landing in China. At this rate of job creation, we won't reach pre-recession employment levels until about 2015. The headline numbers also don't capture America's unemployment divide, said Zachary Carabel in the DailyBeast.com. There's no real crisis for people with college degrees or for women in service industries, but unemployment for minorities and men with only a high school education remains chronically high. We now have an underclass of millions who may never find permanent, well-paying work, and Washington appears incapable of doing much about it. That makes our employment conundrum that much more intractable. And you're listening to The Week magazine for January 20th, 2012. Now we'll turn to the controversy of the week. Obama, did his appointments violate the Constitution? Every president swears an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. But President Obama is thumbing his nose at it. When the Senate is in recess, the Constitution lets the president fill vital jobs by so-called recess appointments, bypassing Senate consent. Obama used that power last week to name Richard Cordray, head of the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, as well as to fill 3 seats at the National Labor Relations Board. The only problem, said Edwin Meese and Todd Gaziano in the Washington Post, is that the Senate was in session. Using a parliamentary procedure devised by Democrats to block the last President Bush's recess appointments, Republicans have been holding minute-long pro forma Senate sessions every 4 days to keep the Senate technically in business. Obama unilaterally decided that the Senate was in recess anyway, so in what House Speaker John Boehner rightly called an extraordinary and unprecedented power grab, the president simply went ahead and made his appointments, a tyrannical usurpation of power that will surely be challenged in court. Republicans are the ones defying the Constitution, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. Most of them have admitted that Cordray, Ohio's former attorney general, is well qualified to run the new consumer agency. Their only goal in using filibusters to keep those agencies, or to block his nomination, rather, and those of the NLRB nominees, was to keep those agencies from functioning as intended by law, to crack down on banks that cheat consumers and on employers who abuse workers. As Obama put it last week, when Congress refuses to act in a way that hurts our economy and puts people at risk, I have an obligation as president to do what I can without them. Obama's on firm legal ground here, said Harvard University constitutional law professor Lawrence Tribe in the New York Times. Senate Republicans are distorting their advice and consent role by refusing to vote on presidential appointments so as to paralyze entire agencies. If these appointments are challenged in court, the case ought to be a slam dunk for the White House. Quite the opposite, said Stanford University constitutional law professor Michael McConnell in the Wall Street Journal. The Constitution plainly states that both houses of Congress must agree to an adjournment, and neither the Senate nor the House did. So the Senate was legally in session, and even if Obama were to win in court, Democrats would one day regret this president's imperial arrogance. He's opened the door to some future Republican president ignoring constitutional niceties and governing by executive fiat. Beware, precedents created by one administration will be exploited by the next. The White House would actually welcome a court battle on this issue, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, because it plays right into its election strategy for 2012. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was a centerpiece of the popular Wall Street reforms that Democrats passed in 2010. Obama would love voters to see him fighting to defend middle-class consumers from the predations of big business and the Republican Party standing in the way. Finally, Obama is acting like a partisan, said Robert Kuttner in AmericanProspect.org, and standing up to GOP obstructionism. His liberal base is thrilled, and as for conservatives, banks, and Wall Street, they couldn't hate him any more than they already do. In the spirit of Franklin Roosevelt, he might as well earn that hatred. And now from the Week magazine, we will turn to the very popular section entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for a penny saved after a rare 1793 U.S. penny was sold for $1.4 million at an auction in Orlando, a record amount for U.S. copper coins sold at auction. It was a good week for Charlie Sheen, who announced this week that he'd given up his goddesses, winning, and bizarre rants. I'm not crazy anymore, Sheen said. He described the new Charlie as a single dad who is devoted to his children and is much more rooted in reality. And it was a good week for eating in peace after a restaurant in Portsmouth, New Hampshire posted a sign that said, "No politicians, no exceptions," in the days before the Republican primary. Employee Jessica LaBrie explained that customers were complaining that constant visits from presidential candidates were disrupting their meals. It was a bad week for Bezo Doodoo Zoppity Bop Bop Bop, a Wisconsin man who changed his name from Jeffrey Drew Wilkshee after he was arrested for possession of marijuana and a knife. It was a bad week for Pittsburgh Mayor Luke Robinstall, who donned a Denver Broncos jersey and T-bowed, dropping to one knee with his hand prayerfully on his forehead after losing a bet to Denver's mayor. Last week, Tim Tebow and the Broncos beat the Pittsburgh Steelers in the playoffs. And it was a bad week for the male of the species after physicist Stephen Hawking, who is renowned for his work on the most complex questions of astrophysics, admitted he's stumped by one topic he thinks about often. Women, said Hawking, they are a complete mystery. And now we'll flip through the pages of the Week magazine to the People section for this week. Our first item is entitled Styler's Tantric Trials. Trudy Styler has packed a lot into her 58 years, said Brioni Gordon in the London Telegraph. Raised in public housing in central England, she is now an actress, a producer, a yoga expert, and the wife of multimillionaire rock star Sting. Yet there's only one thing most people know about her. Are you asking about that old tantric thing? She says mischievously, rumors began circulating about Styler and Sting's epic sex sessions in 1990, she says, after her husband gave a drunken interview alongside Irish rocker Bob Geldof. At one point, the journalist asked how long they could go for, and Geldof said he was a three-minute man, but as Sting did yoga, he could probably go on for hours. And Sting said, "Well, haven't you heard of tantric sex?" Geldof replies, "No, I haven't." Styler says her husband explained that the practice involved caring for your partner, really engaging in intimacy before you, you know, have sex. But that detail never made it into the final story. She now wishes Sting had kept his mouth shut. He was completely rat-arsed, she said. At the time, I thought it was very amusing, but then it sort of became a cause celebre. The tantric hours got extended, and suddenly I was doing it all day long. Well, if only. The next item is entitled, The Chef Who Lost Clinton's Cake. Roland Mesnier has satisfied the sugar cravings of some of the world's most powerful men, said Carol Ross Joint in Washingtonian. During his 26 years as the White House's head pastry chef, Mesnier served up delectable desserts to five presidents, making pecan bourbon pie for Jimmy Carter, orange chocolate cake for Ronald Reagan, baked apple souffle for Bush Sr., and buttered brioche pudding with dried blueberries and lemon sauce for Bush the Younger. His most demanding diner, though, was Bill Clinton. He had a big appetite. Scary, says Mesnier, 67 years old now. He could eat five or six pork chops. Clinton was also allergic to a stack of foods, including chocolate and flour. But he loved dessert. It made it very difficult for a pastry chef. One evening, Mesnier crafted a low-calorie strawberry cake for Clinton, who ate half the dessert in a single sitting. The next morning, the president woke up craving a slice or two more, but no one could find the cake, says Mesnier, who had to face the furious commander-in-chief. Clinton was pounding on the table and shouting, "I want my damned cake!" When the missing cake couldn't be found, there was only one conclusion to be made. We decided that Vice President Al Gore must have eaten it. And the next item from People is entitled, Craig's Years of Rage. Daniel Craig grew up angry, said Stephen Roderick in Men's Journal. When he was 4 years old, his parents split, and Craig moved with his mother and older sister from the well-to-do English city of Chester to nearby Liverpool, where Thatcherism was a dirty word and unemployment was at Detroit levels. His art teacher mom would take him to watch political plays at the city's left-wing theaters. "You'd go and laugh at the government," said Craig, 43. "Laugh at the fact that Liverpool had this reputation of being full of thieves, because it was full of thieves. People were stealing hubcaps to try and make some money to feed their kids." The teenage Craig often spent his evenings boozing and brawling in local pubs. "I wasn't a particularly good fighter," the James Bond actor admits. "I'm still not." He escaped Liverpool when he was 16, winning a place at London's prestigious National Youth Theatre. But Craig held on to his sense of rage, which he now directs at everything from politicians to acting something he dismisses as bulls. If it says on my gravestone, "Daniel Craig, grumpy twat," then fine, he says. There you go. Now it's time for us to read from The Briefing this week, a popular column, and this one is entitled The German Colossus. Europe's largest country is thriving while much of the continent faces economic ruin. Why? How did Germany become Europe's dominant economy? Mostly through simple diligence, Germany doesn't owe its success to spectacular innovations or new industries. It's largely the product of steady, stable growth in existing niche industries, a government-private sector partnership, and the German aversion to excess spending and debt. This successful formula has put Germany radically at odds with its deeply indebted European Union partners. Germany's unemployment in December stood at 6.8%. Spain's, by contrast, had risen above 20%. While Greece, Spain, Portugal, and Italy are now swallowing painful cuts in government spending and employee benefits, most Germans say the euro crisis hasn't affected them personally at all. Germany, in fact, is now the only European country with enough money to bail out its suffering neighbors. Not surprisingly, most Germans are deeply skeptical about any bailout. Their sentiments were reflected in a recent Bild headline, "They all want our money." How does Europe feel about Germany? Well, the resentment is palpable, especially in struggling Greece and Italy, which haven't forgotten their domination by the Germans in World War II. Germany's economic strength has enabled Chancellor Angela Merkel to demand that other Eurozone countries adopt German budgetary virtue in return for some assistance in paying their debts. In Greece, the Greek government acquiescence to these demands has led to charges that these leaders are traitors. Stathis Stavropoulos, a prominent political cartoonist who has depicted Germans as Nazis forcing the Greeks to hand over their money, summed up prevailing sentiment this way: what Germany did not manage with weapons during World War II and is now trying to do through economic means. Do Germans work harder than other Europeans? No, at least not in sheer time spent on the job. Because of generous vacation policies and shorter working days, German workers logged an average of 1,419 hours in 2010, compared with 1,778 hours in Italy and the U.S., and 2,109 hours in Greece. But they work smarter. Germany manufactures well-engineered products that people all over the world buy at high prices. In 2010, Germany exported $1.3 trillion in goods, over $200 billion more than it imported. With a population of 82 million people, Germany nearly equals the total export revenue of China, which has 1.3 billion people. Much of what Germany makes is all but invisible to the consumer, who has no idea that a Weissmann boiler heats her water or that a Leitz planer finished her tabletop. That's a Leitz planer that has finished her tabletop. But such products add up, along with all those Mercedes and Volkswagens and driveways from Mumbai to Malibu. Are Germans thriftier? Without a doubt, the preference for saving money rather than spending it is built into their language, in which the word for debt, Schulden, is the plural word of the word for guilt, Schuld. Germans save an estimated 11.3% of their disposable household income, more than twice the rate of Italians or Americans. The aversion to debt and to inflation has its roots in the early 1920s, when the German central bank's efforts to print money to pay reparations for World War I led to prices doubling every day. Bread eventually sold for 105 billion marks, or a wheelbarrow full of bills. Have Germans always been frugal? Well, not always. As recently as 2003, Germany was considered the sick man of Europe. It was reeling under an estimated $1.9 trillion in government spending in the 1990s to modernize East Germany, and suffered both high unemployment and low growth. Driven to act, Social Democrat Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder fought the unions and many in his own left-wing party to limit unemployment benefits, rein in pensions, and reform the labor market. His unpopular policies, called Agenda 2010, contributed to his defeat in 2005, but they set Germany on a path to strong, stable economic growth. So austerity is their secret. Partly, but not entirely. Modern Germany is neither a socialist paradise nor a model of laissez-faire capitalism. Instead, the German economy is based on close partnerships between the public and private sectors, and between management and workers. A network of state-funded research institutes helps incubate innovation, and worker representatives have long sat on a German corporate boards. Before the euro crisis hit, these partners hashed out a scheme called Gurzarbeit, or short-time work, under which the government agreed to supplement wages if companies reduced hours for skilled workers rather than laying them off entirely. Bertram Kaspari, personnel director of Mercedes truck factory south of Berlin, was told in 2008 to slash production by half. "We did not fire a single person," he said, "not one." If Germany has a lesson for other nations, it's that far-sighted political and business leadership can work wonders. especially if they work together, says Stephen Ratner, the financier and former Obama administration auto industry czar. The German model shows that a developed country can remain competitive even in a world where new economic giants such as China and India and others are emerging, Ratner says. And the footnote to today's briefing section is entitled, The Middlestand's Advantage. The U.S. has its high-gloss innovators, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook. Don't look for their counterparts in Germany, where all of the top 10 companies have pre-World War II roots. What makes the German economy hum isn't so much young firms as relentless innovation within old ones, especially the many family-run manufacturers that make up the Mittelstand. These are companies that found niches and transformed them over time into larger markets. Stihl AG, for instance, got its start in 1923 when Andreas Stihl invented an early electric chainsaw, which weighed in at about 140 pounds. Now the company, run by Stihl's son, is the world market leader in handheld outdoor power equipment with plants in Virginia, Brazil, and China. Versions of that story exist in towns throughout Germany, from Wendenden, where Karcher makes pressure washers, to Nürtingen, where Kugler-Womacko builds machines that put the spirals in spiral notebooks. Put simply, Germany is thriving because its companies make high-quality products and they value people. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to the Week magazine. The first one is entitled The Truth About Secular America, written by Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. American culture is sick, and secularism is the cause of our disease. That, said Steve Chapman, is the contention of religious conservatives like presidential candidate Rick Santorum, who insists that feminists, liberals, and gay marriage have undermined traditional morality and that only a return to our Christian roots will cure what ails us. But all evidence suggests that this view is not only backward, it's wrong. As America has become more secular in recent decades, most indicators of moral and social health have gotten better, not worse. Crime has plummeted. Teen pregnancy is down by 39%. Divorce rates are dropping. Abortion rates among adolescents are half what they used to be. Which states continue to have the biggest social problems? The Bible Belt states, not the supposedly sin-ridden blue states. Mississippi has the nation's highest rate of church attendance and also the highest murder rate. Liberal Vermont's murder rate, on the other hand, is 25% of the national average. Massachusetts, the first state to legalize gay marriage, has the nation's lowest divorce rate. So please spare us the sanctimonious fairy tales. Secular America is doing just fine. The next column is entitled The Most Entertaining Drama on TV by Rob Walker in the New York Times. Herman Cain's spectacular rise and subsequent flameout. The swaggering gunslinger Rick Perry's oops moment on live TV. Rick Santorum and Ron Paul rising from the fringes to challenge Mitt Romney. Is it any wonder, said Rob Walker, that this year's Republican presidential race is being compared to soap operas and reality TV? Ratings for the GOP debates are setting new records, and no wonder they're the best thing happening in pop culture right now. Pretentious sourpusses sniff that politics is too important to be treated like Survivor, a horse race, or a popularity contest. But horse races are exciting. Elections are popularity contests, and no reality TV show features characters remotely as fascinating as would-be presidents with their singular blend of masochism and megalomania. If it's a high-minded examination of issues you prefer, fine. Go to Romney's website to read his 160-page economic plan. As for me, give me the dramatic tension, narrative richness, and exciting plot twists of candidates vying for the White House. It's far more entertaining than anything you'll see on The X Factor. And the third column for this week is California Can't Afford Bullet Trains by Charles Lane in the Washington Post. High-speed rail is headed for a dead end, said Charles Lane. A new review panel appointed by California's legislature concluded last week that the state should not issue $2.7 billion in bonds to start work on 130 miles of track for a proposed bullet train through the San Joaquin Valley. Governor Jerry Brown wants to go ahead anyway, insisting that the state has to commit to high-speed rail now or lose out on $3.3 billion in federal funding. But it's absurd for a state facing chronic deficits, tax increases, and social spending cuts to gamble billions on high-speed rail, when all evidence indicates that it would be a colossal waste of money. In 2008, California voters approved a high-speed rail system stretching from San Diego to Sacramento on the premise that it would cost $33 billion. But the projected cost has since soared to $98 billion. The market for high-speed rail, meanwhile, seems more dubious than ever. Flying between Los Angeles and San Francisco takes but an hour and is relatively cheap, and good luck getting Californians out of their cars. High-speed rail is nothing but a gold-plated fantasy, and it's still not too late to hit the brakes. And now we'll flip through the pages to the very back of the Week magazine for the column entitled The Last Word. And the particular article this week is entitled How Dishing Got Dirty. Gossip has always been with us, says Joseph Epstein, but the Internet has made it faster and meaner. Gossip has long had ferociously bad press. But the major rap against it, that is trivial, is no longer the main thing to be said about it, if it ever was. For gossip has come to play a larger and larger role in public life in ways that can thrum with significance and odd side effects. Until the invention and widespread use of the Internet, gossip could be conveniently divided between private and public spheres. Private gossip, the engine of English novels from Jane Austen to Barbara Pym, is largely restricted to include friends and enemies and acquaintances. Public gossip, which has been around since the printing press, is about people who appear in print or on radio or television, broadcast for the titillation of the larger world. To qualify for public gossip, one formerly had to have achieved some measure of fame or notoriety. But with the advent of the Internet, one can arrive at notoriety without having first achieved anything. And like the distinction between gossip and news, that between the private and the public has become blurred in the digital age. The Internet, writes legal scholar Daniel Sullivan, is transforming the nature and effects of gossip. In his book, The Future of Reputation, Gossip, Rumor, and Privacy on the Internet, Sullivan recounts the story of an insensitive remark that appeared online, supposedly spoken by the clothing designer Tommy Hilfiger. If I had known that African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians would buy my clothes, I would not have made them so nice. Hilfiger is also supposed to have confirmed that he made this most impolitic remark on Oprah, causing Ms. Winfrey to throw him off her show and tell her audience not to buy his clothes. The effect of this caused Hilfiger's business to slump drastically. The problem is that Tommy Hilfiger never made the remark, nor had he ever appeared on Oprah. But the story was out there in cyberspace. You'll find it is still out there today. Salovey tells the story of a girl in South Korea who refused to clean up after her dog on a subway. A fellow rider with a cell phone camera caught her in the act of refusal and passed it along to someone else who put it on his blog. A man with a much more popular blog picked it up and put it on his site, and from there it took off, so that the girl became known around the world as the dog poop girl. She was henceforth harassed, as was her family, and because of it she eventually decided it would be best to drop out of the university she attended. The moral here isn't that you should always clean up after your dog, even though you should, but that you never know who's watching, and if it's the wrong person and he has a phone camera and a friend with a blog, it can mean serious trouble. Not long ago, in the Styles section of the Sunday New York Times, a young woman wrote a letter to an advice columnist saying that she had recently broken up with her boyfriend, who wrote about the breakup in his blog in a way that made her look bad. The problem is, as she notes, if a prospective employer decides to search for her name on Google and discovers all the terrible things her ex-boyfriend has said about her, it could, or more than could, it is likely to, be damaging to her chances of getting the job, not to speak of getting future boyfriends. The Internet has been splendid in the freedom it has given people to express their opinions and catching out politicians in egregious lies and journalists in shoddy practice and in so much else, but it is the other side of that freedom, the freedom to libel, to invade privacy, to wreck lives, that has gotten so little, though greatly needed, attention. Professor Salovey remarks that the Internet is historically in its adolescence, and it is precisely as an adolescent that it now tends to act, wildly, thoughtlessly, destructively. Lars Nelson of the New York Daily News has called the Internet, in this aspect of its young career, a vanity press for the demented, and this is a more than an amusing phrase. Salovey tells of a young woman working in the office of a U.S. senator who published a blog in which she blithely set out the details of her sex life. Her activity was frequent, and the details she supplied were copious, including the oddities of the appetites of the men with whom she bedded down. This man preferred only anal sex. That one had a taste for spanking. Another gave her money for sex, that sort of thing. Soon enough, her blog, originally meant only for a few of her friends, was picked up by a Beltway blog called Wongcat, itself known for its bawdiness, which had a large following, and presently the young woman's name and the details of her sex life were broadcast much more widely than she claims at first she intended. The strangeness of the story is that the young woman didn't seem to mind the publicity. She rather liked the notoriety it brought her. Public embarrassment, she wrote, is really very liberating. You really stop caring about what people think, which is something only the elderly seem to be able to accomplish with great aplomb. So I am way ahead of everybody. And those of you behind me can kiss my ass, she said. Some of the men she wrote about felt much less at ease with public embarrassment than she, and at least one, who argued that he was readily identifiable in her blog, sued her for invasion of privacy, claiming severe emotional distress, humiliation, embarrassment, and anguish. Hard cheese on him, as the English say. The young woman, whose name is Jessica Cutler, flourished, at least as we understand flourishing in contemporary life. She was interviewed and photographed naked by Playboy. She wrote a novel called The Washingtonian, the name of her blog, for which she is said to have been paid a $300,000 advance. And she eventually married a bankruptcy lawyer with whom she has had a daughter. No business like blog business, at least for some. Malice is also too often an element of gossip, and the Internet, in this connection, can be a powerful aid to malice by spreading falsehoods or even harmful truths with a speed undreamed of by small-town, over-the-back-fence gossips. Sometimes not even malice is required for the Internet to do its job as an engine for gossip. Things are mentioned on one blog, picked up by another, linked by a third to two others, and soon something meant to be strictly intramural becomes global. Gossip has its good qualities in supplying information, important information, not available in any other form, and its destructive ones when motivated by meanness and the intent to bring a person down. The Internet, it turns out, also has a vigilante or posse function that is an arm of gossip. In this respect, you not only accuse a person of wrongdoing, but also join forces with others to round him up, as in the case of the poor dog poop girl. Blogs exist, among other things, to shame people who fall below what are thought to be proper standards of behavior, in which the people who do so are named for anyone to see. I learned from Professor Salovey's book that there is a blog called Bitter Waitress, which names poor tippers on what it calls the Shitty Tipper Database, or anyone who leaves tips of under 15, or in some cases 20% of the check. The best-selling writer Malcolm Gladwell found himself named on this blog, though he claims not to recollect ever under-tipping. But once his name appeared on the list, his claims counted for nothing. Another such blog is called Don't Hate Him Girl, which lists men and their profiles, who in their relationships with women have been disloyal, sexually aggressive, liars, mama's boys, and any other information that is useful in condemning these men. All this information may be quite true. Men, as I am fond of telling my granddaughter, are brutes, but what if some of it isn't? What if some of the names are placed there because a woman feels falsely betrayed, or is herself psychologically off-kilter, or is seeking revenge for a man's not finding her attractive? In Don't Date Him Girl and other such blogs, the old question arises, who is guarding the guardians? The blog, with its absence of face-to-face contact, provides something very like whiskey courage, cyber courage, let us call it, and it cannot be a good thing. In its destructive aspect, gossip is about two things, the ruination of reputation and the invasion of privacy. No institution does these two things more efficiently than the Internet, where gossip can be menacing and will remain menacing until the time when laws come into being to guard against its many excesses. It's difficult even to think about the complexity of such laws, which would require guaranteeing both freedom of speech and protection of reputation and privacy. But the need for them is becoming more and more acute, as became evident when in 2010, an 18-year-old student at Rutgers University, after two classmates photographed him with a webcam having sex with another male student, took his own life. As far as I know, I have never been directly gossiped about on the Internet. I live, after all, a dullish life that does not provide much fodder for exotic gossip. But I have been insulted innumerable times online, as has anyone who writes for the general public. And insults not made to your face, but with the capacity to be instantly widespread, are an indirect form of gossip. Stendhal said that to write a book is to risk being shot at in public. But until the Internet, one didn't know all the tender places in which one could be shot. And there is no redress, not really, not likely, not ever, not so long as the Internet remains the playground of the too often pathological and the Valhalla of the invalorous, where the unqualified and the outright foolish can say what they please about whom they please, which in the end amounts, as Molly Haskell has it, to democracy's revenge on democracy. Meanwhile, until such time as laws governing behavior in cyberspace are made, or at least an etiquette for Internet behavior is developed, we are all potentially Internet victims. So clean up after your dog. Never leave less than a 20% tip. Be more than attentive and courtly on dates. Do not divorce or break up with a partner. In fact, maybe you'd do better never to leave your apartment. What with all those little big brothers and sisters out there watching you? And that was excerpted from Gossip by Joseph Epstein, reprinted by permission from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishing Company. All rights reserved. And you're listening to our reading of the week magazine for this week here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks for joining me today. Let's turn to the talking point section here, and there's an article that I think you'll enjoy called Movies, Why Ticket Sales Are Dropping. Americans are deserting the movie theater in droves, said Brad Tuttle in Time.com. Domestic box office receipts in 2011 were down 4.5% from the year before, despite increased ticket prices for 3D and IMAX movies, while attendance continued a 9-year decline. Movie theaters sold 50 million fewer tickets last year than in 2010. More and more people seem to be giving the modern-day movie-going experience a thumbs down. The reasons are obvious, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. Hollywood now routinely churns out an underwhelming and unoriginal slate of sequels and action movies aimed primarily at a teen audience. But young people today would rather spend their money and time on astonishingly realistic video games such as Modern Warfare 3, which generated $1 billion in sales in 2 weeks. Older film fans, meanwhile, are taking advantage of new technologies in the living room to avoid high ticket and concession prices, waiting to see movies when they're available via Netflix or on demand. To get their audiences back, theaters should consider lowering their prices, said Derek Thompson, TheAtlantic.com. The average price for a movie ticket passed $8 this year for the first time, and a ticket can cost as much as $13 in cities. Bafflingly, that price stays the same no matter what movie you watch, be it a holiday season juggernaut like Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, or an indie movie like Young Adult. This one-price-for-all approach doesn't make sense. Movie theaters have already made money by charging higher prices for 3D and IMAX movies. Couldn't they experiment with charging lower prices for smaller, less popular movies, or even discounted prices on weekdays? That kind of dynamic pricing could fill a lot of empty seats. Price is only part of the problem, said Roger Ebert in ChicagoSunTimes.com. Theater chains seem to think the only films that interest moviegoers are blockbuster franchises based on comic books or toys. That's why the same few overhyped disappointments can be found in every local gigantoplex. But the one bright spot in 2011 was the surprisingly good ticket sales for indie, foreign language, and documentary films. If movie theaters provide a true variety of films, stop ripping off customers with overpriced snacks, and police the cell phone yakkers and texters, audiences will come back. Americans love the movies as much as ever. It's the theaters that are losing their charm. The next column, or next article, I should say, is entitled Electric Cars, a Disappointing Start. The electric car industry was supposed to spark into life in 2011, said Chris Woodyard in USA Today, but instead the plug-in car revolution began to look like a flop. American consumers bought only 20,000 electric cars last year, far short of the pace expected by President Obama, who predicted that 1 million would be on the road by 2015. General Motors had hoped to sell 10,000 Chevy Volts in 2011, but managed to move only 7,600 of them, while Nissan sold 8,700 Leafs. A survey found that just 0.6% of Americans would consider buying a Volt, citing its comparatively high $39,995 price, the hassle and substantial expense of installing a home charger, and the fact that you can drive only about 25 miles on a charge before the gas engine has to kick in. Clearly, the federal government should stop subsidizing these impractical vehicles, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Despite a $7,500 tax credit for purchasers, electric vehicles remain expensive toys that only the rich can afford. This is an industry that is not ready for prime time. It's too early to consign EVs to history's crusher, said Peter Gorey in TorontoStar.com. The Chevy Volt sales dropped last year after a battery fire occurred in testing, but they've since picked up. Owners praise its smooth, silent operation and cheap running costs. Other major automakers are still pressing ahead with their own electric vehicles, showing that there's life in the industry yet. Both Ford and Toyota are releasing mass model EVs this year, that's electric vehicles, and Nissan expects to sell 250,000 Leafs throughout the world by 2014. As batteries improve and electric cars run longer between charges, interest will continue to grow. It will be years before we know if the electric car has a real future. Let's be honest, the Volts and the Leafs now on the road are just pilot projects, not viable competitors to gas-powered cars, says Brian Walsh in Time.com. The car of the future will need to be cheaper and capable of covering longer distances. That could take years of research and development. But technological revolutions rarely occur in 1 year or even five. The dream of greener motoring is far from dead. While electric vehicle sales fizzled in 2011, sales of small, cheap cars with great gas mileage, like the Chevy Cruze, boomed. As gasoline gets increasingly expensive, automakers will find a strong market for energy-efficient vehicles, however they're powered. And we'll take a look at a few shorter items as we near the end of our program today. To be counted among the world's richest 1%, a single individual has to earn just $34,000 a year. Members of the planet's true middle class, meanwhile, live on just $1,225 a year. Unusually mild winter weather has prevented lakes and ponds from freezing from the Midwest to the Northeast, keeping ice fishermen, skaters, and hockey players sidelined. In normally frigid Minnesota, temperatures topped a record 60 degrees on a recent January day, while Buffalo has had less snow so far than in any year in more than 80 years. The number of twins born in the U.S. has doubled since 1982, largely because of fertility treatments. One of every 30 babies is now born a twin. And cancer fatality rates have dropped by 23% in men and 15% in women over two decades. Even so, over 577,000 people in the U.S. will die from the disease this year. And now let's look in our poll watch for this week. A record high percentage of Americans identify themselves as independents. 40% of Americans now say they are independents, compared with 31% who say they're Democrats and 27% who identify themselves as Republicans. And 58% of Republican primary voters say they want more presidential candidate choices than the current field, a 12% increase since October. 37% say they are satisfied with the candidates who are running now. And we run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website. So long, until next time.